topic of enlightenment has come up in the past couple of days. In a way, it's the topic of all of Zen and all of Buddha Dharma. It's the goal of the practice, even when we say there's no goal, and avoid the topic of this E word. So I thought today we could explore it a little bit more. I think we have been, all these stories about ordinary mind being the way are about this very point. The word enlightenment in English, I think, as I was maybe saying to the group or maybe saying to one of you, I think is a strange term. It doesn't... well, for one thing, it sounds like a thing. It's something, enlightenment. Whereas awakening, for example, sounds more of an event or a process rather than a thing. And then, so these are both terms translating these various words from the tradition, like Bodhi, the Buddha used. Bodhi related to Buddha, same root word, which means literally like awake. And it's related to the English word bud, actually, the Sanskrit and Pali. Buddha is apparently related to the English word bud, which is like opening. The word opening came up the other day. Opening, blossoming, awakening, flower.
What a great thing to name a religion.
Exactly. Buddhism.
And as Coven's tree, I don't know if you've seen it, but...
And Coven's...
they're the size of walnuts. I mean, they're like, it's beyond.
And he named his kind of organization Bodhi, I think Coben did. So we have, that's the Pali and Sanskrit. The Buddha used other words too, like nirvana, when it has more of a negative sense about the same opening, awakening. It's the release of fire from its fuel is the ancient etymological root of this word nirvana. Sometimes translated as extinction, but that sounds like something that happened to dinosaurs. But cessation, I think we could say. And then in Chinese and Japanese, we have all these creative words that the translators were looking for to connect this new, strange Indian religion with their native Chinese Taoist understanding. Taoist based on the Tao, which is usually translated as the way. So they actually took the word Tao, or the way, and used that to translate Bodhi, and made it a kind of a Buddhist term. Now, we could, in a Judeo-Christian culture, we could take the word God and use that to translate Bodhi. maybe. And some do, you know, opening to God, the formless source of all things. And yet it's kind of a loaded word for us too, so we usually don't. And so we have the way, and then we also have words like go, which is the Chinese way of saying satori in Japanese, which, as I mentioned, is just this, you know, it's not a special Buddhist term, it's just in the Japanese language, it means to understand or perceive something. And then we have the word more connected with Rinzai Zen lineage of Kensho, which means seeing nature. You're literally seeing nature. And you could say nature is short for Buddha nature, or self nature with a capital S, like true nature, seeing the actual nature of the way things are. And then there's words like that Dogen also uses, like kaku in Japanese, which literally means like awakening. And maybe Dogen's most classic term for this this basis of the practice and the path is this term shusho, practice realization, or practice verification. In English, we put a dash between them. So the non-dual practice and verification. Verification of Bodhi. We could say this is short for. But practice and verification are not two. So as Harry brought up the other day, this one teacher who had some satori, had some insight into how things are, and said, oh, I see this doesn't depend on sitting meditation. And so he stopped and maybe even encouraged his students to, you know, you really don't need to do this sitting thing. And you know, I can relate to where he might be coming from. Like, it doesn't depend on anything, any particular thing. If it's a goal that arises eventually after lots of sitting meditation, that would not be the ordinary mind that's present. It would not be the all-pervading way. So Dogen was very careful to very exquisitely present Zazen, sitting meditation, as not a means to an end, as not a means to achieve satori or awakening, but as an expression of it, a very direct expression of what already is. And on the ultimate level, we could say everything is expressing it equally. And that's probably how this teacher felt. It's like, well, why are we singling out this meditation thing and saying this is more connected with this awakening than just washing the dishes or something? And this is true. And yet, sitting meditation, it's such a beautiful expression of ordinary mind, because it's so simple. Because it's just like, it's physically and possibly even mentally not doing anything, not adding anything extra to anything. That spirit is verifies that which is without lack or excess, the way that's just like as it is. So we we settle into and accord with the way by just sitting, not adding anything or subtracting anything from what's happening. But not as a way to like, okay, if I keep doing this, then I'll get to this thing called enlightenment. That already, that whole way of thinking about it, as Nan Chuan said, turns away from it. Because it's not somewhere else, it's just being more and more in accord with what already is. And I think we have these two approaches, two extreme approaches to this controversial topic of enlightenment. One is to make it into a thing and a goal that we have to arrive at in the future, and if we don't get it, our practice is worthless, and so on. That's one extreme. And then the other extreme is to say, well, it's not anything at all, and there's nothing more than our, you know, habitual churning patterns of deluded consciousness. And because they all say, this is it, well then that, this must be it, and you know, it's a little more disappointing than I thought when I first came to practice and I thought there'd be this nice enlightenment thing. But I can accept it, it's okay. This is all there is, and you know, and I guess this is all the Buddha was just, you know, this walking around with this churning habits of deluded consciousness, and the whole path is just based on just that's okay. That would be kind of another extreme. And both of them have some truth in them, actually, you know, to really completely accept this deluded, churning mind of habitual consciousness is the essential path to understanding ordinary mind. And so is there a middle way that doesn't fall into either of these extremes? Very difficult to talk about, I think. And, you know, I hesitate to even get into it, but it's the last day of Sesshin. And it's a small group.
You can just tell us all to forget it at the end, it doesn't go well.
Okay.
Is that less than the defilement that it's a small group?
Maybe, yeah. So, Thomas Cleary, you know, who is a human being with particular views, has various opinions and ways of talking about this. But I think he's a brilliant person, and you know, he's one of our great translators of Dogen and the sutras and many Chinese ancestors. I think he's really working with these ideas as he looks into these teachings. So he's just picking up on, as an introduction to this transmission of light, which is Keizan Zenji's Denko Roku, which later this summer or sometime we're going to do a Denkoe Sesshin, where we'll just go into these teachings of this, these transmission of light stories of our Soto ancestors. But in the introduction he says, as Zen writings commonly refer to Satori, you can use this word Satori, meaning understanding, as realization of original mind, we could say also ordinary mind, as it is in itself, universal ground of consciousness, concealed beneath the temporal conditioning that forces people to experience life through outlooks arbitrarily limited by their cultural, social, and personal histories. he's kind of a wordy guy, but maybe a nice working definition. So Satori is the realization of this original mind as it is in itself, the universal ground of consciousness, meaning like all different ways of dualistic and non-dualistic conceiving of the world, concealed beneath the temporal conditioning that forces people to experience life through outlooks arbitrarily limited by their cultural, social, and personal histories. This realization of this ground of mind, original mind, is considered the essential initiatory experience of Zen. Like, you know, when the Zen path actually really begins, according to him, in that it allows the individual access, it allows the person access to a range of mental potential beyond the limitations of outlook defined by ordinary processes of acculturation, socialization, and education. So Satori is therefore said to be the key to inner freedom and independence, door to higher knowledge realized by all enlightened people. In the words of Dogen, quote, as each of them attained escape from the shell, they were unencumbered by previous views and understandings, and what had long been unclear suddenly became apparent. Escaping from the shell of habitually conditioned views. And going back to, this is maybe we'll talk, it's such a huge topic, this awakening thing, that this is kind of Zen angle on things. So all different traditions have many different stories and within Buddha Dharma, and yet there's certain qualities that seem to be agreed upon. And I thought that the teaching that was brought up in the Four Noble Truths class at one point about these four types of grasping, and as the Buddha says in the sutra we chanted this morning, the cessation of discontent, the cessation of suffering, is the cessation of grasping, the five skandhas. And then these types of grasping are these four types of grasping. Grasping views, opinions, or fixed viewpoints about anything is one of them. And grasping specific practices and even ethical standards in a fixed kind of way, that as the path to liberation in itself, and grasping sense objects, pleasurable sense objects, holding on to certain experiences, and grasping this one particular view of the self, of the independent self. It's something in addition to five skandhas, that there's some underlying person pulling the strings, I think, as he mentions in here too. There's somebody behind the control panel inside, like, you know, that's just a metaphor, but on some deep level we seem to experience the world like, and that's the one, the control panel operator in there is the one who gets really hurt when the five skandhas are, you know, accused or confronted or hurt in some way. It's not just that five skandhas, the body takes a little beating, or the mind takes a little insult or something like that. But I mean, that has its effects. But really, the pain comes in, the suffering comes in, of when the little person at the control panel says, "Actually, they're doing that to me." And so the Buddha is saying, if we go in there, it's like an empty control room. There's all these like panels and wires and networks of karmic conditioning. Basically, it's the source of the dependent co-arising of what we call this person. But there's nobody there, like, pushing the buttons. It's an empty room, and there never was anybody there. And yet, it all works. On the outside, it looks like there must be somebody there, because how does it all coordinate so nicely? It's amazing, miracle of dependent co-arising. So, and Thomas Cleary mentions this similar metaphor. And he also mentions about how after you're saying this is an initiatory experience, because then, that, you know, people sometimes take that to be the end of practice, when you just see things free of this view of the internal controller, even for a moment maybe, and then we go back to our habitual. It doesn't like wipe out the habit patterns. And all the different schools of Buddhism talk about this stages, actually. And Zen doesn't get so into stages, but in some ways, there we can say, like, some Zen people have talked about, there's the sudden, instant realization, and then there's the gradual practice afterwards. There's gradual practice before, maybe, but it's not... it's misunderstood. But then there's the integrating the insight into our daily life. And also when we start to think about enlightenment and awakening and something that I want to get, it seems like in a way it's the wrong... And we ask, how do I get there? How do I realize it? In a way, it's like the wrongly directed question. We could say, maybe more helpful to ask, what is it that's preventing it? Actually, what am I grasping? What am I grasping? So this is like Dogen's chant that we did by revealing and disclosing our lack of faith in practice. Constantly assessing in this hopefully calm and relaxed and possibly even joyful way, revealing and disclosing our oh wow, I'm stuck there, in the way that like ordinary mind is all pervading everything, but like it's not being accessed because of this stuck habit pattern, something like that. So it's not so much how can I get the ordinary, unconditioned mind, but more like, it's already here, but what's blocking it? And as my teacher sometimes has said, making a karmic, or what is it? Making a neurotic inventory. In other words, like an inventory of all our neuroses. And you could even write it down as a long list. And I've done this, and I have these records from earlier days of practice of like, these are the things holding on to, and I could even rank them in order. And it's interesting to go back and look now, because some of them are not such issues, and some are like, that's still, wow, this one is like tenacious. Or some of them have like, maybe have, the manifestation of them has shifted, and it's like the underlying grasping that fueled that particular thing is now operating in a different way, something like that. But these moments of ordinary mind seem like they're the moments when actually we're just not grasping anything, and then if we want to return there, instead of saying where is that place, they just look for where am I holding on? Sometimes hard to tell, but Sesshin is a great time for this. In a moment-to-moment way, during Zazen even, during like, if I'm not completely content and resting joyfully in Zazen, we could say that means I'm actually holding on to something, that could be very subtle mentally. And, what is it? And can it be released? And this is the whole Four Noble Truths thing, too, in a very experiential kind of way. And learning, we learn about ourselves so much by sitting here day after day, don't we? Like, this pattern, just what's, this is a very familiar one. You're like, this is a new one. So this integration, even after kind of understanding ordinary mind, and knowing that it's possible to live free from grasping, then it's like really getting to work and like looking at all these different forms and seeing how we can let go. And if we can't let go, though, what is that about? Is there a view below the thing that we can't let go of that's really what we can't let go of? And this kind of offhand, I would propose that this thing about the independent self, I'd say, is pretty much the root of all of it. So it's like, I can't let go of, being late or something like that. But actually, what's underlying that? Well, it's the, greed to do a little, to read an extra sentence or something. But what's underlying that? And it really comes down to this, I'm holding this old pattern of, there's somebody here who is like, independent. And it may be hard to make that connection offhand with this example, but we can make these links in our own experience. There's somebody in here that's or another way to put it is identity. We're grasping our identity. This may be a nice way to put it, because there is a dependently arisen self, this body of mind, this collection of skandhas, but a kind of a fixed identity, and which we naturally hold to is like our unique way of being me, and everything that goes along with maintaining that, feeling like we have to maintain it. Everything will work out fine if we don't. I mean, our unique conditioning will keep us a unique person. But we feel like we have to hold it together somehow. So Thomas Cleary says, the new life after Satori is richer for having let go of circumstantially ingrained attachments, biases, and blind spots that close minds into tunnel visions of life and make individuals, groups, and masses vulnerable to manipulation. And then this image. An ancient Zen master said, see the playing puppets on the stage. Seeing the playing of the puppets on the stage, all along there's someone inside pulling the strings. Without Satori, people are like puppets on the stage. On awakening, they realize who is pulling the strings. There are nevertheless definite drawbacks associated with specific reactions to the Zen teaching of Satori. Most of these drawbacks, well documented throughout Zen literature, are related in some way to responses people manifest to the emphasis traditionally placed on Satori in Zen training. And maybe we de-emphasize it more in American Zen, and maybe we go too far to the other extreme. But classically, because it's like this thing, people make it into the thing extreme, and then they're trying to get it. So one such problem is neglect of adequate preparation due to eagerness for quick results. And then this quote that I think is from the Blue Cliff Record. This quote is, no one knows the sweating horses of the past. They only want to talk over the achievement that crowns the age. Kind of like, isn't it great? Like, ordinary mind, like, this is it. But, like, we forget the sweating horses of the past means, like, when you read the stories of these ancestors, this was like work. And, you know, again, we can make work into, like, you know, hard practice or something. But I would understand this mostly as, like, inner work, as deep inner honesty, radical honesty with ourself about where we're holding and what it's about, and deep investigation. And hopefully we don't have to literally sweat. But maybe okay if we do. This attitude may prevent satori altogether. You know, this eagerness for quick results. It may induce the person in the state to mistake exciting states for satori, or to make the enthusiast unable to sustain an occasional intimation or glimpse of the experience. And another classic Zen quote, "Everything gained in battle is ruined by celebrating."
What do you think about that?
It's kind of like, you know, in a way, it's like if ordinary mind is what's gained in battle, then celebrating, in a way, actually, distorts it, or it adds something extra to it. You know, celebrating is, we don't celebrate something ordinary. Right? So, you know, we did ordinary mind, like amazing! And then it's like, well, wait a second, is it still so ordinary? Or is there some, you know, and celebrating, I think, maybe clarify the word celebrating. I think it's celebrating in a, you know, making it into something bigger than it is, and in order to grasp it, and particularly again, it's the way that the self, that this independent self, or the identity, like if, you know, especially as sincere Zen students, and this is the goal of the thing, like we get a little bit of it maybe, and then it's like, yes, this is what my job is, to get this, and like, got it, like, let's celebrate, come on. And then, but then, you know, that's not my job. My job's not to celebrate. But there could be a celebration that's a very, a celebration called Zazen. That's just very unexciting celebration. That just...
So I'm going to leave, and I'll leave with a quote from Bob Dylan. When your ship comes in, you can charge admission on the deck or sail it out again. I think that applies.
Nice, yeah. Yeah, so, seeing this great time to sell it out again and again and again. And this last quotation about celebrating also alludes to another typical shortcoming, failure to consummate satori by carelessness in its aftermath. Satori is not the end of Zen, it's more properly the true beginning. Those who stop here are traditionally said to have, quote, gained a little and considered it enough. And this is a tricky thing too, because it's all about contentment, right? And letting go of discontent and resting in contentment. And yet, there's the shadow side of resting in contentment that would be like, consider it, you know, I'm content enough. I think I maybe mentioned at some point in here about sometimes I've felt like I've had this problem that when things are going too well for me. I told that story. I used to think of this like when life or practice is going along smoothly, I have this like kind of gnawing. I'd make that into kind of a discontent and a sense that there's no incentive to keep going, or, you know, go deeper. Like, you know, this is enough peace. I found my way, or another way to put it too, I think especially and sashin, I've heard it talked about, like, we find our kind of, like, our way to kind of, like, do sashin. We find our sort of comfortable, sort of, how to say it, like...
Groove
or something, yeah. Like, just a way to do it. We're used to, you know, we kind of, like, you know, compared to the first sashin, we kind of, like, know what it's like, we know what to expect, and, like, we can do it, and we're just going to be patient, and we can sit, and we can be here, and yet to, and isn't that enough? And then what would be something deeper without striving or seeking? This gets very subtle. But, letting the natural curiosity and bodhicitta even of mind to actually, if it asks, you know, is there could there be anything deeper? To let the question arise and let the investigation happen. This is just another Zen proverb. Refers to this defect of, you know, gaining a little and considering it enough. Is the level ground is littered with skulls. Strange image, but the leveled ground, yeah, which I see it as like we're kind of climbing up a mountain, and then like get to this plateau of just like cool levelness. It's no longer like a struggle. And we might find this place in sashin, and like, ah, and I basically get the thing of what this is about, and like, just, now just continue, and then just dying there, kind of complacently dying on this level ground, and really there's another hill above this ground. But there's all these, it's littered with skulls of all the people who's just like camping out on the level ground and not going further. At least that's how I take the image. Kind of intense image though. The level ground is littered with skulls. And then it goes on. The experts are those who pass through the forest of thorns. Maybe that's what's beyond the level ground, is the forest of thorns. Can we just rest in the level ground, please? And leave our skull here. Well, so as... another quote is, lesser enlightenment, after all, turns out to be a hindrance to greater enlightenment. But if you give up lesser enlightenments and don't cling to them, greater enlightenment will surely be realized. If you grasp a little enlightenment and don't relinquish it, great enlightenment will surely be ignored. This is like someone so greedy for a little profit that he doesn't get a big profit. If he doesn't cling greedily to a little profit, great profit will eventually be realized. If he accumulates small profits, eventually it will amount to a great profit. And, you know, we can also see the reverse side of this. It's like, well, why do we want a bigger profit? You know, I think there's always deviations with even these things, because it's like, what about just contentment? Contentment. Is there grasping? Okay, really seek contentment. And is there something more than this? And so again, it's like, without seeking or grasping, how can deeper truths open? So I also want to bring up, in our little time remaining, a little more of Huangbo and Lin Ji, this wonderful group of these Lin Ji ancestors, Matsu, Baijiang, Huangbo, Lin Ji, and that's seeing how they all have, like, how they influence each other over time. And I think some of these issues about enlightenment are brought out by these teachers. So Huan Bo, yesterday, as I mentioned, said all Buddhas and ordinary people or sentient beings are just one mind, and this mind is beyond all measurements, names, and oppositions. This very being is it. As soon as you stir your mind, you turn away from it. So again, ordinary mind, one mind. And Huang Bo also says, and I think this is a great meditation instruction, just recognize the original mind in perception and cognition, remembering that the original mind is not in perception and cognition, yet not apart from perception and cognition. So, or, you know, you could say perception and cognition are dualistic thinking mind. Even thinking mind, or even if we're very settled and there's almost no discursive thinking going on, still just like, but I still feel like there's me sitting here. But there's, I still really feel like there must be that, there's some identity inside that's me, other than five skandhas. And so this is the original or ordinary mind, the awakened mind. Just recognize that this original mind is in perception. Just recognize the original mind in perception and in cognition, remembering that this original mind is not in the perception and the cognition. It's not in dualistic thinking, yet not apart from dualistic thinking. And this is something to take up as a zazen instruction. You know, while we're actually experiencing the dualistic thinking, how to relate to this ordinary mind. It's not in the dualistic thinking, but it's not apart from it. It's like, so it's right there, right here, pervading everywhere, and yet it's not just the same as our dualistic thinking. Just don't produce views and opinions on top of perceptions and cognitions. Don't stir thoughts on perceptions and cognitions. Don't seek mind outside of perception and cognition. This is, might be a tendency. Well, the ordinary mind is not, because it's not in the perception and cognition, it must be outside of it. It's not in it, but it's not apart from it. So don't seek it outside perception and cognition. Don't abandon perception and cognition to grasp for truth. Not identifying, not rejecting, not dwelling, not sticking. You'll be free in all ways, and then everywhere is the site of awakening. I think this is a really great meditation instruction. Don't produce views and opinions on top of dualistic thinking. Don't stir thoughts on dualistic thinking, you know, elaborating on it, or which might be in the form of, I gotta get rid of it, I gotta stop it. Don't seek mind outside of it. Don't abandon it to grasp for the truth. Not identifying with it as me. This is, again, the self. Not identifying with this dualistic thinking as who I really am. It's just conditioned stuff of the mind. Not rejecting it, not dwelling in it, not sticking. So, Huang Bo. And then, so, Huang Bo, one day entered the hall to speak. And when the assembly had gathered, he said, "What is it that you people are seeking here?" He then used his staff to try to drive them away. like swing out, get out. But they wouldn't leave. And then he said, "You people are all dreg slurpers." Have you heard this?
Yeah, I didn't know that was him, though.
Yes, this is Huang Bo. Yeah, yeah.
The slap.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You people are all drag slurpers, meaning like you're like what's left in like the best wine casket at the bottom. The wine of the ancestors' words is like delicious, and it's just a spontaneous expression. But now you're trying to like slurp up the dregs from the bottom of the barrel, and like, you know, what did that ancestor say? And so this is very humbling, quoting all these words of ancestors to look at this possibility of dreg slurping and seeking. Are we seeking something from Dharma teachings? If you go on a pilgrimage visiting teachers, seeking in this way, you'll just earn people's laughter. When you see 800 or 1,000 people gathered somewhere, you go there. So isn't it great that they have these communities of 1,000 people? But I think we have this in America. It's like the teachers that get really popular, I think then it's like this critical mass happens, and like everybody just goes, oh, it must be like the best Dharma because that's where everybody is. I think you're referring to that, you know, it's a natural tendency. Not to say that, I mean, there's probably something about the Dharma that actually is worthwhile, but I think at some point it becomes like this critical mass effect too. People like don't even really know one way or the other, but it's like, it's just about, I mean, in a way, like a place like Tassajara is like that. People aren't even coming for the Dharma. There's no particular Dharma. The teachers are constantly changing, but the place has a reputation. So there's always going to be people there. Tassajara, yeah, it's like the first Zen monastery in America. And like, but so? But it's got this reputation. And then he says, don't you know that today in all of China there are no Zen teachers? So, not seeking outside oneself, in the words of the ancestors or others. And then a monk came forward and said, in all directions there are these people expounding to countless students. Why do you say there's no Zen teachers? And Huangbo says, I didn't say there's no Zen, just that there's no teachers. So that's something to contemplate about whether ordinary mind can ever really be taught. I don't say there's no Zen and no ordinary mind. It's just that there's no teachers of ordinary mind. Well, what about Huangbo? He teaches ordinary mind. But not really. In a way, it's like just by actually even coining the term, it's, you know, obscured. In a way, it's made into something. There's no teachers of Zen. What a relief. And so then, this teacher named Lin Ji came to practice with Huangbo. And,
was he a young student?
Yes.
Or was he already young?
I think he was young. Let's see. It doesn't say here, but I think, as I recall, he was a young student. Yeah, came to Huangbo in his early years, and his from the beginning of his residence at Mount Huangbo, Linji's performance of his duties was exemplary. He was a good monk. And at that time, this other teacher, who later to become teacher, Mu Zhao Dao Ming, served as the head monk, as the Shusou. And so this, you might have heard this story, but it's such a great story, I have to tell it. Feels like there's some like dread-like stuff in my mouth. Mucho asked, the head monk asked Linji, how long have you been practicing here at Huangbo? And Linji said, 3 years. And Mucho said, have you gone for an interview? Have you gone to Dokusan with the teacher or not? And Linji said, I haven't done so. I don't know what to ask him. So he's been there 3 years, and somewhere I saw there was one of the ancient commentaries said, this must be a later addition by somebody else, because Huangbo would never let somebody be there for 3 years and not come to Dokusan. I thought that was an interesting little commentary by some other classical Zen teacher. You know, as a compassionate teacher, he wouldn't let him just like flounder like that for so long. And Linji's so innocent, right? I haven't gone to him because I don't know what to ask. And so Mucho, the head monk says, why don't you ask him? What is the essential meaning of Buddha Dharma? What's the essential meaning of Buddhism? Just the classic question. Why don't you ask him like the ultimate question? You know, it's just the standard Zen question. Go ask him that, and like I'm sure there'll be like a lively encounter. And it's funny because Linji also, it seems like he's so innocent. He's just like, oh, okay, I'll go ask him that. I never thought of that before. So Linji goes to Huangbo and starts asking, what is the essential? But before he could finish his question, Huangbo hit him. Finally, they got to meet. And then Linji left and went back to the head monk, Mu Chao, and said, well, what happened when you asked him? And Linji said, before I could get the words out, he hit me. I don't understand. And Mu Chao says, go ask him again. So Linji asked Huangbo again, and Huangbo again hit him. And so then he went back and reports it. Well, go ask him again. So a third time he goes and asks, what's the ultimate essential meaning of Buddha Dharma? And Huangbo hits him again. And now he's really like dejected and broken down. And finally he got the nerve to see the teacher, went, and just all he got was hit. And he's like, I must be, you know, totally ignorant. So Linji goes back to the head monk and says, before you urged me to ask about the Dharma, but all I got was a beating. Because of evil karmic hindrances, I'm not able to comprehend the essential mystery. So today I'm going to leave. So this really got, you know, something's happening now, at least for Linji. He was a great exemplary monk for 3 years. Probably thought he was doing fine. He had nothing particular to ask, was just going along. And now he's like totally dejected. He was doing fine before. Now he's like, I guess I don't understand. And I'm going to leave. It's like my karmic affinity. Maybe I'll just even stop practice because I really like just one simple question and I just get hit. I should just maybe just even give up. And the head monk says, well, if you're going to leave, you say goodbye to the master first. And so then the head monk went to Huangbo, the teacher, and said, that monk who you asked the questions, or the monk who asked you the questions, although he's young, so he is young, he is very extraordinary. If he comes to say goodbye to you, please give him appropriate instruction. Later he'll become this great tree under which everyone on earth will find refreshing shade. Which he did later. So the next day, when Linji came to say goodbye to Huangbo, the teacher said, you don't need to go someplace else, but just go over to this Gaoan monastery and practice with Dai Yu, his friend, maybe like next door. He'll explain it to you. So Linji went to Dai Yu and said, Dayu said, where have you come from? And Linji said, from Huangbo. And Dayu said, what did Huangbo say? And Linji explained, 3 times I asked him the essential meaning of Buddha Dharma, and 3 times I got hit. I don't know where my fault was. I don't know if I made some error or not. And Dayu said, Huangbo has old grandmotherly affection. So kind. Literally says, like, you know, his grandmother mind. Grandmotherly affection, and endures all this difficulty for your sake. And here you are asking whether you've made some error or not. And upon hearing these words, Lin Ji realized Satori. He understood, he awakened to ordinary mind. What did he see? He was caught up in his struggles with himself. Like, I don't understand. And I thought I was doing okay, but like, obviously I'm getting hit like this, and so there's something I don't get, and I'm so bad. We might have such thoughts sometimes, right? I can't believe I've been practicing all this time and still, like, I think like this. And I really don't understand. And even stories like this, what is this about? So Dayu says, oh, he was so kind, like a grandmother to you. And you're asking about your fault? So this was Lin Ji's great awakening. Lin Ji, the founder of the Rinzai school, understood deeply, maybe for the first time, this ordinary mind by opening to the way that that his seeking question was answered immediately and directly with great kindness. And upon his Linji's awakening, he was different, because then he said, now I see, like, there's actually not much to Huangbo's Dharma after all. He was very confident at this point, right? Huangbo's Dharma isn't so great. After he was like, I couldn't understand it. You know, there was some meaning that I couldn't understand. Now I see, there's not much to it after all. Dayu, he's still talking with Dayu, you know, Wangbo's friend, this other teacher, and Dayu grabbed him and said, why, you little bedwetter? And just for, you know, as a footnote, all the different translations, they all say bedwetter. I think it was literally some kind of insulting term. You just came and said you don't understand, and now you say there's not so much to Wangbo's teaching? What do you see? Speak, speak! So Lin Ji then hit Dayu 3 times. Boom, 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 on the ribs. And Dayu let him go, kind of pushed him away, and said, your teacher is Huangbo. I've got nothing to do with this. These ancestors are...
So what a beginning.
Yeah, yeah. So this is, yeah, the beginning of Lin Ji's expression of Dharma, right?
When did he start shouting?
Soon.
Okay.
Soon. And I think that's nice that Dayu says, you know, and I understand this is Dayu's, understands this whole thing too, and he just kind of like pushes him away, but with actually great loving affection, I think. Because these guys just, they play rough, you know. And he says, your teacher's Huangbo. I've got nothing to do with this. You know, you're going to have some interesting times with Huangbo. Now you go with going back with this attitude. And so Lin Ji left and returned to Huangbo. And Huangbo saw him and said, this fellow who's coming and going, you know, he's going and coming and going. When will he ever stop? You know. You felt like you had to leave and you left. Now you're coming back. You know, kind of like insulting him for like changing his mind, right? And, how will you ever stop? And then he said, only through your grandmotherly concern. I will stop and have stopped, you know, we could say. Linji then bowed and stood in front of Huangbo, just presented himself. And Huangbo said, "Who has gone and returned?" And Linji said, "Yesterday I received the master's compassionate instruction." Being hit three times. "Today I went and practiced at Dayu's." Huangbo said, "Well, what did Dayu say?" Linji recounted his meeting with Dayu about being told of Linji's grandmotherly kindness. And Huangbo said, "That old fellow Dayu talks too much. Next time I see him, I'll give him a swat." And isn't this great that, like, Linji is greatly awakened through Dayu's words, but then Huangbo is like, "He talks too much. He made it too easy for you, basically. He told you how my grandmotherly kindness is so kind. He gave you everything. He was too grandmotherly kind. But I'll swat him next time." And then Linji said, "Why wait until later? Here's a swat right now." And so Linji hit Huangbo. And there's several stories later in the record of Linji about this, like, talking about some future event, often about hitting, you know, deserves to be hit or something. And there's this very immediate present response, like, "Why wait till later? Whack!" And, you know, even though... because it's all about present expression, which is exactly what Linji understood from Huangbo's grandmotherly kindness, that immediate contact. There's nothing in words that will express Dharma so directly. So then Huangbo kind of, you know, scolds him and says, "This crazy fellow has come here and grabbed the tiger's whiskers." Right? You know, you hit the teacher, it's like grabbing the tiger's whiskers. And Linji shouted, maybe for the first time. So this is Linji's first hit and first shout, which he later became famous for. You know, "This crazy fellow has come here and grabbed the tiger's whiskers." "Ah!" Huangbo then called his attendant, "Take this crazy man to the practice hall and put him on a cushion." And then they really enjoyed practicing together. So that's Linji's awakening. And then Linji has many wonderful, wonderful teachings in the record of Linji. But it's maybe my favorite. And it's similar. I think this is, you can see the thread running through all these stories about Huangbo saying, "Don't you realize that there's no teachers of Zen in all of China? And that an ordinary mind is the way, but if you direct yourself towards it, you go astray." All this about seeking outwardly, seeking from anybody else or anything else, or even any other of our own mind outside of this very mind, this moment. So, Linji says later, "When students today fail to make progress, where's the fault?" The fault lies in the fact that they don't trust themselves. They don't have faith in themselves. And what's themselves? Who is ourself to trust? I would propose that it doesn't mean our habitual, turning, constricted, grasping, self-concerned mind. Ourself, our true self, ordinary mind. But he doesn't clarify this here. He just says they don't trust themselves. If you don't trust yourself, then you'll be forever in a hurry trying to keep up with everything around you. You'll be twisted and turned by whatever environment you're in, and you can never move freely. But if you can just stop this mind that goes rushing around moment by moment looking for something, then you'll be no different from the Buddhas and ancestors. Do you want to get to know the Buddhas and ancestors? They're none other than you, the people standing in front of me listening to this Dharma talk. Students don't have enough trust in themselves and they rush around looking for something outside themselves. But even if they get something, all there will be is words and phrases, pretty appearances. They'll never get to the living thought of the ancestors. Make no mistake, you followers of Zen, if you don't find it in this life, then for 1,000 lifetimes and 10,000 kalpas, you'll be reborn again and again in the threefold world. You'll be lured off by what you think are favorable environments and be born in the belly of a donkey or cow. Followers of the way, as I look at it, we're no different from Shakyamuni. In all our various activities each day, is there anything we lack? And how wonderful that he's not saying, you know, my mind is not different from Shakyamuni Buddha. He's saying, followers of the way, all of us, we're no different. Is there anything we lack? The wonderful light of the six senses has never for a moment ceased to shine. If you could just look at it this way, then you'd be like the kind of person who has nothing to do for the rest of his life. So, the six senses, or the five skandhas, just shining as they are, just dependently arisen, body and mind, arising and ceasing due to all the conditions of this miraculous world and this life. Shining as they are with no identity holding it all together and nobody at the control panel. Ordinary mind. Ordinary mind. Would anyone like to bring up anything before we finish the dreg slurping talking part of the sesshin? Same here. Yeah. That the small means it's only the most sincere who have been able to come. I mean, we shouldn't say that those who aren't here are not sincere, of course, but the sincerity of the people here is readily apparent. And very inspiring to be doing this and floundering through this haze around the ordinary mind and this event we call sesshin, stumbling through the days. And meanwhile, the sun just shines on us all, and the flowers open and the birds sing.
I had signed up for another song that I'm hearing they say.
No, we can still talk.
Because I don't mean to defile an intention for no more words.
We can still talk again this afternoon. Just no more words in this format. Shall we have a little lunch before we have a little break, a little work period, and a little more zazen, and continue with our precious life of practicing the Buddha way. We dedicate the merit of this Dharma gathering to the complete, perfect awakening of all beings. Beings are numberless, I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible, I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless, I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable, I